Welcome to the Sports Science Dudes. I am your host, Dr. Jose Antonio, and filling in for co-hosting duties today is Dr. Tim Ziegenfuss. Tim's a distinguished sports nutrition and exercise scientist, holding prominent roles, including the CEO of the Center for Applied Health Sciences. His contributions span from shaping the natural products market, to working with elite athletes, military, and also being featured in top media outlets. Now, I do want to let you know that if you're a first-time listener, hit the subscribe button and like the show. We're on YouTube, Rumble, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify, so we can be found everywhere. Now, today, our special guest is Dr. Michael Sagner. He's a clinician and researcher specializing in sports medicine and preventive medicine. He is a certified nutritionist and completed his MD at Technical University in Munich. He specializes in sports medicine, endocrinology and preventive medicine, and had an affiliation with the College of Applied Health Sciences, University of Illinois, Chicago. He's the editor-in-chief of Progress in Preventive Medicine, a fellow of the Royal Society of Medicine. I love how in Europe they use the Royal Society. That always sounds cool. We don't have that in the United States. We don't have a Royal Society. I want a Royal Society.
So you have the United States.
So, and he's also a fellow of the European Society for Preventive Medicine. As a public health expert, he spearheaded several international initiatives in the field of systems biology-driven preventive medicine, working with governments and NGOs. One of his interests is closing the gap between clinical practice and public health to promote more effective and patient-oriented care and preventive interventions. The good doctor is currently the chief executive officer of ESPM, not to be confused, Timothy, with ESPN,
right.
The European Society of Preventive Medicine.
I know
and
that.
He's partner of the European Innovation Partnership on Active and Healthy Aging. So I'd like to welcome Dr. Sagner to the Sports Science Dude. Welcome, doctor. How the hell are you doing?
I'm superb. Thanks,
Joe. You know, you're our first European guest, so it's good to have someone from the other side of the pond, as they say. I do want to ask you a little bit about your history, because when I was an undergraduate in college, my father, who actually is a physician, he was an MD. He passed away a couple of years ago, but he was a physician.
It's 4 o'clock.
Is that a, what was that?
Sorry. That might have been my. It's just 4 o'clock here on the East Coast.
It is 4 o'clock. And he said, why don't you just go into medicine? And I said, well, because I don't like being around sick people. And I learned when I was a little kid, he'd bring me to the hospital. I was like, man, I can't stand this hospital. I don't like the smell of it. I don't like seeing sick people. And so I decided to go into science, which I don't know how many are familiar with the Filipino culture, but there's only three professions you're allowed to pick: medicine, accounting, and law. No one ever goes into science. So I'm like, you know what? I ain't going to do this medicine. And I hate accounting and screw law. I think I'll go into science. So that was sort of my foray into eliminating all the traditional Asian professions and going into science. And now, I don't know if Timothy has a story like that, but I want to know your story as to why you chose medicine, because as you and I know, and Tim knows, I think medicine, there seems to be I don't know what it is. Medicine needs to sort of re-examine itself, because I think a lot of people have become very skeptical of medicine vis-a-vis the last 2 or 3 years. So how did you get into it? And, you know, tell us your story.
So how did I get into medicine? I was always interested in physiology, really. It started with sports and just training, and literally, I think I was in a gym and just wondering about, you know, what is this actually doing? How is this actually doing its job? What is this doing? And just asking questions about physiology and anatomy. And then not having had the privileged background, I joined the military and then got a scholarship, and I was able to pick a university in Europe. And at the time, there was only one university that had an affiliation with Harvard, and that was Munich. And so I thought, I don't know where that place is, but I'll just go. So that allowed me to spend some time at Harvard University.
So you'd never been there?
No, before, no. So that was just someplace, and I picked it because it had a good reputation. And at the time, it was actually, and still, Oxford, I think, and Cambridge is still not, I mean, Oxford might be in the top five, but it's basically American universities making the top five for MDs, which is interesting. It doesn't mean that you are going to be a good physician, you know, graduating from one of these universities, and that applies obviously to many other fields. Yeah, so sports medicine, sports physiology was always my main interest, and I wanted to be an orthopedic surgeon because I thought that's what sports medicine is all about. And then when I actually trained in surgery, and it was usually, it's always the same stuff. Trauma surgery is a big, obviously it's a big thing. It's very different. It's always different. But the usual stuff is elbows, shoulders, knees, and hips, lower back. And the solution is usually, well, the guidelines are exercise, which we don't really do, right? we don't even recommend that, really. It's just, it's written somewhere. And then we start injecting stuff. And then it's pretty, surgery. It's surgery for you.
But you tried to change that, right? I mean, that's part of your life. That's part of your mission lately, right? In the last couple of decades.
Yeah.
The whole preventive, right? Not to get ahead of you, but.
Yeah, absolutely. So when I was just, I was finishing my internship and residency, and a couple of big studies showed that lower back and knee surgery, and you guys know this, is placebo, right? A lot of the stuff that we do in orthopedic surgery, especially if it's elective surgery, it's nonsensical, makes no difference. It would be better to go to the gym, maybe use some good supplements. And that was a huge, I think it was the Lancet, it was a couple of other journals, big studies, and it was such a shocker. Obviously, if you have a car accident, you want a good trauma surgeon, right? But if you have lower back pain, knee pain, do you want to see an orthopedic surgeon? Or you want to see Tim? You?
You know, Tim?
I have a bad, I have two bad shoulders. I have lots of injuries, but I would like the body to heal itself as much as it can. And I'm going to do whatever I can to exercise, right? And do my own physical therapy and just see how my functionality returns. And my rule of thumb is if I can do 80% of what I used to do without getting surgery, then I'm not getting surgery.
That's you know what's interesting, Michael and Tim? I have a niece, and she, I don't even know if she's 30 yet, and she was suffering from chronic low back pain. She doesn't exercise. She smokes. She's overweight. She decided to get her vertebrae fused. I forget what level, it was like L4 or 5 or something, and I said, that is not what you want to do, because in the long run, you're going to be much worse off. You're going to lose complete mobility down there. But of course, no one wants to exercise. No one wants to eat better. Losing weight's hard. But then again, being in pain when you're 40 and 50 years old, that's worse. And I think, and I'm sure you see this a lot of people view medicine, particularly surgery, as, oh my God, it's magical. I'm going to get fixed. I'm going into surgery, and when I wake up, okay, I'll be in a little pain, but all of a sudden I'm cured. And I tell people all the time, that is your last resort. You have to do everything before you do that. Thoughts?
Yeah. So maybe just to continue. So when these studies came out, I was just getting my board certification. I then read actually your book, the sports supplement book, which must have come out just a couple of years,
two decades ago.
Yes, a long bit, pretty old now. It was your book, and I'm not kidding. I thought, you know what, hormones are pretty interesting, and obviously moving from bones to hormones is a pretty big jump. So I then did night shifts in A&E, so the emergency room, and did a second board certification in endocrinology. I moved from the biggest body parts that we have to one of the smallest molecules that we can find. And I then spent some time in Ohio to do a project on exercise and glucose uptake.
Wait, where in Ohio?
Ohio State.
How did I not know that?
Wait,
So,
what years? Sorry, Tim, what years?
go ahead.
Yeah, that must have been, well, I have to look that up. 2000 and could have 2008 maybe. I'll send you the dates, but it was a collaboration between three different universities, and it was about, at the time we didn't really understand that glucose uptake is improved by exercise, right? That there's a glucose uptake transporters and things changed. It was very new stuff, and now it's, we know it's happening. It's insulin independent, and we did muscle biopsies at the time, and I then thought, man, and actually a guy from some day, I think I was a guy from Rockefeller University, from the diabetes department, forgot his name, who said, you know, this stuff is groundbreaking, you know, exercise, and if we understand this mechanism, we can actually use it. And I thought at that time I made the switch in my head and in my career, because I was always looking at athletes and people, I mean, basically people like us, we want to go to the gym, we want to, you know, we look at what we're eating, drinking, to the 99% of the population. I thought, but this is, we should actually use this in medicine. This is not just for the 1%. Obviously, it's super interesting because we can help optimize nutrition based on that research, and but 99% of the planet have no idea what they're doing, and they don't exercise enough, and we have type 2 diabetes all over the planet. And that's when I left the US thinking I need to spend more time with normal people. People who people don't exercise, who don't like to exercise, people who are, you know, sedentary, who don't understand what proteins and carbohydrates are. And
Michael, if
then
I can I segue on that? I don't mean to interrupt you, but you mentioned diabetes and so on, and I know, I think I read somewhere that your background includes some work with the GLP-1 agonists, right? So you're pretty well versed in that area. So we were just having a little text thread the other day, Joey and I and some other people, and we were commenting on GLP-1 agonists, and of course they're making, you know, million, billions already, right? With these, what are they on, second, third, fourth generation GLP-1 agonists now? I mean, I know that
Second thought,
second, third,
second depends on.
So what's your thought? I mean, initially, when I remember reading about it a couple of years ago, I'm like, well, okay, it's a wicked appetite suppressant, right? It causes the pancreas to squirt out a little bit of insulin, but the main mechanism maybe, and I know it's not, there's not only one mechanism, hardly ever, but was appetite reduction. So people don't eat and then they lose weight. And we know from studies and people who voluntarily fast or involuntarily go on a hunger strike, that not only do they lose, you know, body fat, they lose lean mass. And so that's the concern right now, right? There's a lot of people out there, a lot of registered dietitians and other nutrition specialists are saying, hey, you don't know what the effects are long term, number one, but arguably we really don't, I guess, yet. But second, how much of the percentage of body weight is being lost as really the stuff that is hyper-inflammatory and bad for us, i.e. body fat? And are there ways to maximize losing body fat when you're using a GLP-1 agonist and minimize the loss of lean mass? What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, that's a really good point. So we started using Ozempic, semaglutide, and these substances pretty much immediately after they were approved in the European Union, and that included the UK back then. So we have a lot of experience, and I think the press mentioned something that I was one of the first physicians to prescribe it in the European Union in Europe. So I think I've maybe treated about 2,000 patients with these substances, and I've been, the first thing that patients notice is the loss of appetite, and that's usually what really drives the weight loss. Obviously, as you just said, Tim, there are a lot of, it's a very complex There are many complex pathways that these substances alter, but it's the loss of appetite that is probably the biggest driver of weight loss. And I think, at least the way we prescribe it, the loss of lean body mass is not really a huge thing. Because even if you, let's say you have to lose 40 pounds of fat and you lose 3 pounds of muscle, I'll take that, right? And at the same time, obviously, you have to use that as an incentive. So people who are obese do not just have a physiological issue, they also have psychological issues. I mean, you don't just get there overnight. It's a complex disease, and using the weight loss, these people very often for the first time really lose significant weight, and you can use that to show them that it's possible. Now go to the gym, you don't have to run, because that's the usual thing. They then start fasting, which is now the big thing. They want to run. Back then it was CrossFit or do some other stupid stuff. You don't have to do that. Just do some resistance training, basics of good nutrition, and then we'll take you from there. And just step by step. But that initial weight loss, for some people, it's the first time in 10, 15 years that they've lost more than 10 pounds. So we don't really care about the people who lose it, who care about the lean body mass loss, shouldn't be using Ozempic.
Gotcha. See, we do, like we all do, and the people that in our circle that we rub elbows with, right? We all care about lean mass because it's so hard to get and maintain, especially as we age. So that's why I guess my lens is a little myopic here. I'm coming from the standpoint of, well, geez, like you said, do a little bit of resistance exercise and increase your protein intake, and you might maximize. You know, you might have to be better off in terms of retaining some of that lean mass that's lost.
Yeah, obviously that would be ideal. You go on Ozempic, start losing weight, then. But it's a lot to ask. The patient has to start going to the gym. They have no bloody idea what protein actually is. They think, bread has a lot of protein in it. It's and we all know that. You know, people think they understand nutrition. It's mind blowing how little people actually understand. So we actually take that, it's a side effect. And we obviously recommend upping your protein intake and, you know, go to the gym, start some resistance training, even if it's twice a week, start doing that. And that would be ideal. But if they do lose a bit of lean body mass, we'll take that.
Michael, you said you treated 2000 patients with this, roughly
2000 plus. Yeah.
What's the success rate of people losing weight and keeping it off? And for those people who keep it off, what are the behaviors they're doing that's different from the people who fail at it?
Well, that's very good. So the success rate with Ozempic is pretty high if you get them to do resistance training and up their protein intake. That's the key.
How many?
So there
are
two things. Yeah, that's a good question. In our clinics, it's about 70%, maybe 75. We're pretty tough on our patients.
That's very good. Actually.
Wow.
Yeah, that's very good. Yeah. So people start with Ozempic somewhere else. Sometimes in the States, they come to the UK, and we have to completely restart them on a new program. So people come from very big universities. I don't want to mention any names and famous people. They, you know, give them, here's your pen, go home, come back in 6 months. Let's see what happens. You can't do that. And the people who keep, obviously, as you know, I mean, you can think about the threshold hypothesis or whatever. To keep the weight off, the excess body fat, you'll have to do something. You have to change something. We've had patients on Ozempic and similar substances for over 3 years. And the studies show that you can keep losing weight, but if you want to keep it off, you'll have to do something. And as a good physician, you have to obviously target these things, right? You can't just keep jabbing these people.
Is
so it's Is fiber protein, Jim?
So the last question I have on that topic is, if they stop you, you know, it's like when someone uses creatine or anything else or a fat burner, whatever it is, and they go, well, will I lose all the gains if I stop? I'm like, well, of course you will, because you're not using anything. Is there a wicked rebound, or is there a gain in body weight when someone goes off Ozempic? Or have in your clinic, have you seen, now, listen, they, by the time they're a year or two down the road, they've changed their lifestyle, and so they're better able to maintain a body weight? Or is this like a lifelong med that if they you know, like TRT, listen, if you start TRT, you're probably going to be on TRT for the rest of your life. Is Ozempic and the GLP-1 agonists in that same class of lifelong meds?
We don't know yet. We don't know yet. We try not to keep these patients on Ozempic or similar meds for too long. The lifestyle changes are key, and we try to use the meds to drive the lifestyle changes. Very often, as I said, it's an incentive. They suddenly, you know, they lose 10 pounds, 20 pounds, 15 pounds, and they think, wow, you know, I feel better and I want to stay lean, leaner. It's really about the lifestyle changes. So something very interesting that we might want to talk about is, and it is something that the three of us have been discussing for a long time. So if you use something like testosterone, let's say in your 20 football team, and for a couple of years you use testosterone and some other stuff, very likely you'll have an advantage for life because there'll be epigenetic changes. And this is one of the reasons this transgender discussion is insanely skewed, because once you've been exposed to these hormones, you can't take that away. That's right. And Elizabeth Blackburn and George Church, Elizabeth Blackburn won the Nobel Prize for the telomere research she's done. It's always fascinating how people use these terms. Telomere is obviously a huge thing. People know nothing about telomeres. If you talk to Elizabeth Blackburn, she says, I don't understand telomeres. Yeah, but you won the Nobel Prize for discovering them. She said, I have no idea. I'm just, you know, scratching the surface. And then you have some gurus on Twitter saying, yeah, it, you know, fasting does this and that to your telomeres. And you have no epigenetics, same thing. Epigenetic clocks here and there. When you see, you know, actually talk to the people who discovered this stuff, they say, I don't really know. I'm not really sure. But obviously you have some guy selling you this for, I don't know, $20. It increases your telomere length and telomerase and whatever. Yeah. So what we do know, and I think this is extremely important to understand, and sometimes it's referred to as muscle memory. When you have someone who has been very lean, very muscular, bouncing back, we've seen this in bodybuilders, we've seen this in athletes, it's a lot easier. And it's more extreme than normal people would expect. If you've seen a detrained bodybuilder going back to the gym, I mean, even if you are 100% sure that that guy is clean, it's pretty impressive, right? Look at Kevin LeBron and some of the people. They just bounce back, and there must be some epigenetic mechanisms at play. So the assumption here is that if you get a person to, let's say from 32% body fat to 25, maintain, or 22, let 20 maintain that for a while, hopefully there will be some epigenetic changes.
Yeah, I would imagine that there has to be a difference that if you're treating someone who's grossly obese, so let's say someone, I mean, there are so many TV shows in the United States now of people who weigh 600 pounds or more. I mean, it's become, it's weird that it's so common now that no one thinks about a 600 pound human, that would these, I would imagine these drugs work differently with someone who's 600 pounds versus someone who's 200 pounds and they want to get down to 150. I mean, I would imagine the success rate is different for the 200 pounder versus the 600 pounder. I don't know if you've treated anyone that heavy before.
Yeah, we have. It's not our specialty. These people. So I remember when I started doing my surgical rotation, I had to spend some time doing general surgery. We had this guy who was morbidly obese, and the firefighters had to get him out. And he did bariatric surgery, and then I had to take care of the guy, and he was drinking Häagen-Dazs, which he was melting.
Oh my God.
He was drinking it with it.
Oof.
And that's when I just lost faith. The guy must have been 600 pounds or something. I just, we just saved your life, and you.
Yeah,
So.
I always think it once you've reached 600 pounds, and I guess I'm a little cynical that you'll never get back to a normal weight. I just don't think it's possible at that point.
So at that point, and I think we don't know where that point really is, but at some point, just being chubby. So if you look at, let's say there's a trajectory, right? You get a little bit of weight, so the Christmas weight, then chubbiness, then obese, and then, BMI 35 plus. Obviously, your whole physiology changes. So it's only logical that any substance would, work pretty differently on a 600-pound human being. The body, and as you, I mean, this is something that we might want to explain. Body fat is not just to store energy. It produces hormones, adipokines, and probably other substances that we don't know yet. So it's not just fat being there, being, ugly and sorry, and that's beautiful, obviously.
Hey, so I love curves. I'll be honest.
Yeah, it's
You know?
amazing. It's beautiful.
Yes, that's
So,
nice.
it's not just there to be beautiful, but it's also producing stuff that is not good for the rest of your
You're
body.
right. And I remember reading that, I don't know how long ago when those studies were done where they actually showed that body fat was an endocrine tissue, right? It's releasing all kinds of hormones and hyper-inflammatory cytokines and so on. And I remember reading, it really shocked me, but it was in obese patients with diabetes who got liposuction and a lot of it. And in some cases, it reversed their diabetes. They took out so much of the hyperinflammatory body fat that it, I don't know if cured is the right word, but they got rid of their diabetes just from losing body fat. And it was the, bad fat. So we were told, probably in grad school, good fat and bad fat and white fat is okay, but brown fat is what you want and so on. So what can I do to increase my brown adipose tissue because it's thermogenic and so on. But yeah, the whole idea of adipose tissue as an endocrine organ is just fascinating.
Yeah, that's what we see every day. Being chubby already changes your physiology massively, and we can see your inflammatory markers going up. But once you've reached a certain threshold, it's extremely difficult. You're basically a different human being. It's not, you're not a normal patient anymore. And anything you have, even wounds, don't heal as quickly. And you don't have to be type 2 diabetic, but as soon as you go past this threshold, you are no longer, and even normal meds don't work anymore. You have to triple the dosage, and it's just incredible. And I think, again, we're really just scratching the surface of what this extreme level of body fat does to your physiology, and because we've never seen it before, right? This
Do
is
they see that
the
in
first
sumo
time.
athletes? Like, and again, I apologize for interrupting, but do they have horrible outcomes, health outcomes, sumo wrestlers?
That's very interesting. So that's something that, from a sports medicine perspective, we've looked into. So sumo people, they obviously not they don't want to be fat. They want to be fat strong,
Sure.
and they actually train to be fat for a couple of years, and then they want to lose that fat again. So they use this chow rice broth thing to gain a lot of weight, and then they want to lose it again. If they don't, the health outcomes are pretty bad.
Yeah, they're
But
unique,
it's
right?
part
Because
of,
they're exercising the whole time. They're
yes, and they're pretty
training.
obviously They're strong, strong dudes. Right. So the idea is to get fat and really strong. So it's a pretty bizarre idea. In wrestling, we have weight classes, and they just want to be fat and strong. But it's, especially the genetics of Japanese people, it's not necessarily, you know, it's, most of them are not genetically, they don't have a good predisposition to be extremely powerful and strong. So with this extreme nutrition, they try to gain as much muscle mass and fat as possible, but then they also plan on losing it again, at least as much as possible, to live a healthy life. And we know that from retired sumo wrestlers. So they know that it's hazardous to their health. They don't want to stay like that for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, I've always been a fan of sumo wrestling. I always bring it up as an example that you can't use the term in shape or fit, because it, to exercise physiologists, doesn't make any sense. The way a sumo wrestler trains and eats is specific to sumo wrestling. If they train for American football, it would be, again, a lot different. So when people say, well, that person's fit or is in shape, it's like, well, it really depends on what that person's goal is. There's no such thing as being fit or in shape. Now, I do want to segue a little bit into the European Society of Preventive Medicine, because that's, in fact, I don't even think Tim knows this, but we're gonna have a partnership between ISSN and ESPM. And I know as a physician, you're making a transition, or you've made the transition into more preventive medicine, really health-related things. And in this country, and I know Tim and I probably feel the same way about this, public health experts, and I'll use the term loosely, I guess self-appointed public health experts, I don't know if I have any faith in them. I don't go to them for health advice, ever, ever. So I want your thoughts on that, and talk a little bit about ESPM.
Yeah, well, obviously, I'm excited to announce this partnership, and I think we're going to do some amazing stuff together next year. We'll have this symposium in Oxford, ISSN, ESPM on myokines, exercise, and you'll be there. And people don't know this. Just as we just talked about fat, muscle is it's an extremely interesting organ. People think of muscle as just being there, allows you to move and, you know, breathe, but it's more than that. And we're just discovering how important it really is. So we'll, I think, focus on that, and obviously sports nutrition and how sports nutrition influenced modern nutrition and everything we see now in the media, we've seen 40 years ago. It's just the same stuff again and again. It's sports nutrition. These guys are just using what you've written 20 years ago, 30 years ago. So yeah, the idea that we actually have a healthcare system anywhere on this planet is a joke. We don't have healthcare. There is no healthcare system on this planet. Mention any country. Some people say, but Switzerland must be amazing because it's the paradise, you know, Switzerland, everything's okay. No, it's the same. Trust me, I've been there, I've seen the hospitals. It's disease management. Everything is programmed. So we wait for you to get sick. And in 85% of the cases, it's a chronic disease, a lifestyle related disease. And then we start doing something. And that's usually treating the symptoms while the actual disease is progressing.
Let me interrupt you real quick, because I keep going on that tangent, but I want you to comment on the financial incentives for medicine. I hate to say it, but to keep people sick, because, well, that's how you make money. So comment on that.
Yeah, I mean, it's not even provocative to say that, because obviously in a system that we call it healthcare systems, but it's disease management systems. And that's not being, I'm not trying to be controversial. That's what it is. We're managing diseases, right? Only a small percentage is accidents and acute diseases. It's mostly chronic lifestyle related diseases. And someone once said, if you want to understand something, follow the money. Now, this, since the 50s, Western countries, we've been doing pretty okay. So these diseases, you know, overnutrition, less physical activity, and so on, created this incentive for companies to, you know, feed this, the system, right? Why would you actually want to change it if that is your, it's a massive money machine that.
It's a disincentive, right? I mean, to get people healthy is a disincentive, right? Monetarily.
Yeah, 100%. And at this point, even if you talk to pharma executives, top people behind closed doors, they say, you know, obviously me, you, but this is, a lot of people are going to watch this, but obviously we know what's going on, but look, this is a company. What do you want me to do? Shareholder value, right?
Right. So yeah, there's this chronic, and I mean, I think a lot of people don't understand that humans work on incentives. And if you work for a company, i.e. Pfizer or any company, the incentives are there to make sure, I mean, you're beholden to stockholders, et cetera, et cetera. You got to make sure income comes in, and to make sure income comes in, you got to have a population of consumers. And in the United States, you know, when 3 out of every 4 people are either overweight or obese, you got a lot of consumers for a lot of drugs. And it's interesting here that, you know, people talk about there's a health crisis vis-a-vis overweight and obesity. Yet it keeps going up. I mean, literally every year, rates of overweight and obesity keep going up. I'm thinking, it's crazy when you think 75%, and I think it might be a little lower in the UK, I'm not sure, but I think it's a little lower, but 75% of the American population is either overweight or obese. That means people like you and I, people who exercise and are of normal weight, we are now not only, we're a numerical minority. Now let's take that numerical minority and take people who are not overweight, but also exercise. Now you're talking about a tiny fraction of the human population in Western countries. So it's just flabbergasting how much literally the population has changed in really not that much time at all.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Interestingly, the three of us, we've seen public health experts, you know, talk about nutrition, and doing their thing, you know, taxing staff, doing whatever they were doing 20, 30 years ago, trying to eradicate obesity. What happened? Just kept going up.
Yeah.
Nothing worked. And nobody's going to admit that nothing worked. Taxing this, getting rid of that, you know, soda is bad, this is bad, that's bad, this is bad, do this. Look at the numbers. Just look at the numbers. Nothing has changed. It hasn't even stalled. It just
keeps
increasing. And you talk about the US. So what usually happens is, and this is interesting for people in the US, it usually goes to the UK and then goes to Europe, mainland Europe. So all the trends, nutrition trends, sports trends, supplement trends also, go to the UK, obviously less of a language barrier, and then go to France and the rest of Europe and Italy. And Italy is a huge market for sports supplements, as you know, too. So whatever happens in the US is basically, we know that that's going to happen in the UK and in the rest of Europe. And that's exactly the case with obesity. In the last 10 years, it just keeps going up and up and up. And we have the exact same issues, exact same issues. It's 10, 20 years ago, you could have said, oh my God, we can see this coming, change something. No, same mistakes. And obviously now taking it forward, let's not talk about COVID too much because it's pretty boring. And
we don't want to get banned and tossed off all these platforms, right, Joey?
Right. That's right.
Yeah.
But I mean, when you look at public health, There was an issue, and it's sort of tangentially related to COVID, but we know that the people who tend to have poor outcomes of COVID also tended to have, almost all of them had comorbidities, overweight, obesity, type 2 diabetes, hyperlipidemia, et cetera, et cetera. To me, I was thinking, wouldn't a great public health message be get people moving, get people exercising? Even if COVID didn't exist, it is a great public message. But again, I think the problem is nobody makes money off it. I mean, personal trainers do. I mean, we sort of make money off it because we talk about exercise and nutrition. It's our job, but we're not making pharmaceutical type money. We're basically making a living. So that opportunity was lost. It was lost.
Yeah.
Perfect timing.
I mean, this is...
Go ahead, Michael.
One of the huge, tragedies of this whole, I don't think.
Oh yeah, huge tragedy.
Nobody, everything about it was just wrong. And that nobody, that would have been, with all the mistakes that politicians and public health officials made, that could have been one good thing.
Yeah.
One good thing to save you and do something good. No.
Yeah, exercise for whatever
reason. Not even that.
Yeah. And you know what's interesting, and you know this, and you know, for those of us who work in this field know that if there's a single behavior you can change to improve health and fitness, people say, well, don't smoke. Okay, well, I always assume people aren't smoking. I guess that's a weird assumption on my part, but I assume that. It's dude, just exercise. Just exercise. It's free. It's free. But I guess it's hard. I guess it's hard, right? I mean, Tim, is it hard to exercise? Michael, is it real? I mean, it's not, to me, it's not that hard. You just kind of do it.
I think that's also.
Yeah, you don't pay because you just jump in the water and paddle around a lot. I mean, but if you go to a gym, there are gym fees. But that doesn't mean that you couldn't do some other kind of habitual physical activity that makes you sweat and is strenuous that also counts, right? Like a lot of blue collar guys and girls that are out there that have physically strenuous jobs every day, the last thing they want to hear from us is, hey, you should exercise more and go to the gym, right? They don't want to hear that. And those folks are probably in the minority though, right? When you get a lot of regular, habitual physical activity, hard, strenuous work as part of your 9 to 5 or 8 to 4 or 7 to 3 or whatever the shift you're on, those folks are better off. They might not know it, but they're better off. But that's free.
Yeah.
It's free.
Yeah. We know that from, there's lots of data on it. And people don't look at Jose's pictures of him paddling around Florida because he'll never go to the gym again. Because it's raining here. We have to go to the gym. And you're just, the only dangerous thing is crocodiles or, I don't know,
I got a little scared today because there, I thought an alligator was following me for a while. And I'm like, it sure made me paddle faster though.
See, another incentive.
I was doing HIIT training without actually planning on HIIT training.
Well, that's nature, that's evolution.
That's right.
I think one of the mistakes we might be making in this industry is that we push the gym a bit too much. And when you're doing it, you're just active every single day. You're just out there in nature doing your thing. And I think we might have almost frightened people a bit, that physical activity, especially for health benefits, has to be the gym. And very often it was the treadmill, where you have to be there for an hour. And then you're on the bloody thing for an hour, and it's dreadful.
It's intimidating for a lot of people. I mean, I have friends who they know they need to get more exercise, but they're very intimidated in walking into a gym. Even if I go with them, they're still intimidated. They're never going to go to a, if they go in, they're only going to stay in a certain spot. It might be the cardio area, or it might be the machine area. They're not going to go back where the big boys are banging weights, where the squat racks are, and so on and so on. So it's just not in their headspace. So what can we do to help those folks. Encourage them to do whatever they like to do, right? And make it social. Make it something that they look forward to doing. Yeah.
Don't you find, though, I'm sorry to interrupt, don't you find, though, that, and you tell your friends this, that nobody cares. Like, when you walk in the gym, nobody cares what you're doing. It's
true.
They're not paying attention to you. You might think they are, but believe me, they're so focused on themselves, they don't care. Michael, you had a comment?
Yeah, obviously that's true. Nobody cares. We all had that, right? You're 20 and you're walking at the gym. You want to lift heavy weights.
No, there's a lot of people setting up their cameras for selfies. And I mean, like, even in my gym here in the middle of nowhere in Ohio, like, there's lots of guys and girls, you know, in front of the mirrors taking shot every day I go in there. So whatever floats your boat, however many likes you need, feel good about yourself, whatever. I don't know. Not my thing.
It's the same here.
Yeah,
it's the same here. Obviously, I think well, there are two things actually. First of all, we have to get people away from this idea that cardio is the thing to do, the number one physical activity. This is a chapter it's done and dusted. It's resistance training. Lift some heavy stuff, and.
It's so interesting that pendulum is swinging, right? Like, what, and Joey, what initially, right, guys, it was you should lift weights back in what day was that? Like, Jack LaLanne, well, that wasn't really weight lifting.
That was 1930s, 1940s.
And the running craze came, right?
70s.
And so now the pendulum's starting to swing back, right, toward the resistance training part. And I think it's very interesting that it's swinging back. And so, but there are clear, you know, we understand the science a little bit better now with, you know, Michael, you mentioned myokines before, you know, every time you contract the muscle, it's releasing hormones and other good things into the body. Right. Whereas when you just sit around and don't do anything, your body fat, as it grows, is releasing more bad things into the body. So it's a tug of war. Right. So.
Yeah, I think the data are pretty clear at this point. Obviously, again, in science, we always need more research. Right. But at this point, it's pretty clear that resistance training is king. We need to get people to lift heavy stuff. How do we get people to lift heavy stuff? And so this is another controversial subject, CrossFit, right? I think it was a nice attempt to get people to lift heavier stuff. But so I have a huge story about this. I went to Santa Cruz. So my best deadlift is 600.
And pretty damn good.
I popped a disc in Santa Cruz. Why did it happen in Santa Cruz? Tell me what's going on in Santa Cruz.
Is that Venice Beach? That's not Venice Beach, is it?
No. Santa Cruz. I have no idea. Who's in Santa Cruz?
Is it the CrossFit National Games? That's it? Yeah, bam. There it is.
It's the HQ. And it was, well, this is going to be super controversial now. It was Greg was actually right there, and I never had any back issues in my life. I mean, never ever. And CrossFit is just such a bizarre combo of things that it's not for. I wouldn't recommend it. It's obviously a nice idea, but use different methods. But this is also something that we've been doing for, you know, 60, 70 years. It's nothing new, you know? Mesocycles, different methods, you know, HIIT training, then you do your strength training and so on. But maybe you shouldn't do all of that in one single session. You know, sprint and then try to deadlift and then jerk and clean and...
I think there's a certain body type, right? If you're good at the Olympic lifts and you have certain body structure and biomechanics and so on, then perfect, man. You do you. It's cool. But if you're maybe out of shape to start with and you don't have any experience doing those movements and muscle and biomechanically, your joints aren't just set for that, then I think that's probably a big mistake. The local orthopedic surgeons will thank you for that, for going to your, you know. But again, I have no axe to grind at all for people who – look forward to it and can handle it and do it for reasons I just mentioned, have at it, right?
Yeah, totally agree. Some people obviously are in amazing shape. They can do it and it's super fascinating watching them, right? It's
Their body types, yeah, phenotypically, man, they're when you watch these athletes compete on TV, it's incredible. They have incredible physiques, the men and the women, incredible.
incredible. It's just amazing. But it's not the one solution. And going back to what we just said, maybe focus on something. So maybe something that's sometimes called the barbell strategy. So you don't have to use two extremes, like do resistance training and then just try to walk a lot. Don't do your, thing in the middle. Don't do your.
Yeah, it's interesting. And Tim, the history of this, the idea that, I mean, when CrossFit first came out, I said, well, this is basically just another version of circuit weight training. And you can go back to the 1970s. I don't know if you remember Arthur Jones with his Nautilus equipment.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. What's funny is in college, I actually worked at a Nautilus fitness center. And what was the gist of it? You come in, you're done in 12 minutes, you do 12 exercises, you do 8 to 12 reps to failure, and you're done. Basic circuit weight training. There was nothing magical about it. But it keeps getting rebranded differently. So when CrossFit came out, I'm like, well, it's just circuit weight training, but you're just choosing more random exercises. Now, I actually watch the CrossFit games because it's to me, it's entertaining. However, when people ask me about CrossFit, I answer it from a physiologic, a training standpoint. I say, one, it violates the principle of specificity. You're literally doing so many random things that you're not training for anything. Now, is there anything wrong with that? And then my answer is, well, no, if you're not training for anything, then at least you're exercising. That's a plus. But if you're training to run 5K, a 5K race faster, or training to have a better bench press, or training to be a better baseball player, it's not the way to train because it's not specific to the goal. And but again, there are people who actually like doing random exercises, which for me, I can't do the random exercise. It doesn't fit my mentality. It's like I have to train for something versus just doing stuff, which, hey, doing stuff is still better than doing no stuff, right?
Right.
Yeah, I agree. And I think Tim made a good point. It's for a small group of people who are genetically very gifted. And I have yet to see data that something like CrossFit, and I think we should stop it here, otherwise people are going to go bananas in the comment section. It's not a solution for the obesity crisis or public health crisis. Type 2 diabetes, hypertension. It's really nice to watch. These people are amazing. It's, as you said, it violates a lot of principles of exercise physiology, and it's a specific sport. It's not a solution to the bigger issue that we are facing on this
Exactly.
planet. And it's both physical and mentally, actually, which is something we've been chatting about.
Well, we have just a few minutes left. I want to touch on a couple things. I want to talk about ESPM at the end of the show. But also, I want your thoughts on, because people love lists and they like simple stuff. And they say, hey, Dr. Sagner, give me your top three or top five things that you can do or anyone can do that will maximize your health. And I was about to say enhance longevity, but the fact of the matter is, I'm not sure we actually know. I think we know generally what would do that, but if you're improving health, typically you live longer. So what are those pieces of advice you give to everybody?
Well, I'll give you these three pieces of advice in a second, but there's so much stuff out there now about longevity, influencers, podcasts, about, people sometimes they're not even MDs or board certified MDs. Longevity doctors, we're not going to mention any names, you know who you are.
Are you talking about the celebrity doctors?
Well, people who call themselves celebrity doctors, longevity physicians, and sometimes are not even MDs, and just, there's so much BS out there that it's, the three of us, we're chatting almost every day, I think. It's incredible what they come up with.
Oh, yeah.
And very often, if they find something good, it's usually sports medicine stuff, right? It's things that we found 20 years ago. It's suddenly their new secret, but that's, for us, it's already, that's old stuff. So that's something I always tell people: longevity medicine, or whatever you want to call it, anti-aging. Just look at sports medicine. We've done it already. You know, read some of the old books. You'll find it in there. So, you know, there's so much crazy stuff out there. Just waking up at 4 a.m. and then, you know,
staring. Oh, the cold plunge. How about the cold plunge to start the day?
Yeah.
Or like we talked about that on this podcast before, Joey, but yeah, there's some weird stuff going on. Oh, well, they do it in Finland, or, and they point to a, you know, a different country where they go out in the middle of the winter and they get in a hot tub. Sometimes it's hot, sometimes it's cold. And we know about heat shock proteins, the benefits. We also know that cold plunges probably, although it might decrease soreness acutely, chronic adaptations are going to be impaired if you do repeated cold plunge work. So yeah, they're just bizarre, but anecdotally, right, people will swear by the benefits. I'm with you all the way around. But remember, with regard to aging, and then we'll get off the aging thing, there are those nine pillars of aging, right? There's, and telomeres are one of the nine pillars. And then, and you have all these other eight that are going on. So I think the strategy is, and full disclosure, I've been dabbling a little bit in that area. Michael, I'll share some stuff with you, but that's what we're trying to address. That's what the good folks that are doing science on some of these, whether it's a nutritional intervention or otherwise, you're trying to influence the biomarkers or the pillars of aging. I think that's the approach. But to your point, there is a lot of bullshit out there, to put it nicely.
And there's a lot of bullshit. And I think you're referring to the hallmarks of aging. It's still theory. So I'm part of the University of London Aging Research Group. And being involved in this aging science community, I mean, it's insane how these celebrity podcast people age, and A and others jump to conclusions that are just, you know, how do you come up with this stuff? How do you even, as a scientist, if you call yourself a scientist, can you at least explain how you get from here to here? It would be really interesting to know. It would be fascinating, but it's just every day, it's just more random stuff. And as I said, if sometimes they get it right, it's sports medicine stuff, right? It's stuff that we've known for a long time. It's nothing brand new. But back to your point, the key to longevity is obviously the first thing is to prevent diseases. 85% of premature deaths are due to chronic diseases, lifestyle related diseases. So if you can prevent a heart attack, a stroke, the most common types of cancer, you're pretty good. You're pretty good. And then obviously super interesting is sarcopenia. Just try to, you know, not be super frail as you get older. Which is usually the case when you see someone fit.
Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt. Are you a fan of fasting as a longevity enhancing tool? We know there's data in, you know, in worms and rats and some other species where if you reduce your caloric intake by what, 30%, it's substantial, right? That there may be some health span, or, and again, we have lifespan, then we have health span. We all want better health, right? Okay. I don't want to live till I'm 90 if my last 5 years are in a nursing home somewhere. I want health span. I want healthy years of life. That's what I want. So is fasting one of those things?
Yeah, that's obviously a big one. So for weight loss, the three of us know the data. Pretty clear, makes no difference, right? So if that's your thing, if you want to fast here, there, just do it. But it's probably more efficient to just monitor your calories, get an idea of what you're actually eating and drinking, and then have a long-term strategy. So that's weight loss, and that's usually where people come from, right? So I want to lose weight, and you see all these ads, you know, on Instagram and Twitter, and now it's X now. Losing weight fast here, there, fasting for different body types, which is completely absurd. So I think there's probably a evolutionary mechanism that there might be some benefits to fasting. And by fasting, if you just sleeping is fasting, right? So if let's say you go to bed at 10 p.m., last meal, dinner is 8, then you might have a protein shake or not, and then you wake up at 7 a.m., that's fasting. You're fasting right there. Breakfast. You're breaking the fast. So the idea of building in fasting is pretty natural. You're already doing it every single day. There might be a benefit doing it once in a while. It's probably something that our ancestors have been exposed to on a regular basis, and then followed by feasting, surplus of calories. It's not something magical. We still don't fully understand what's actually happening. So Charles Brenner and some other guys, David Sinclair, so it's different groups of scientists fighting over the idea whether certain genes actually get activated by specific substances and or fasting. And that we don't know. So if you like fasting, if that's your thing, do it. If you don't at this point, it's not something I would recommend. What I usually recommend is don't, eat just 30 minutes before you go to bed. So leave some time between dinner and going to bed. There is evidence that your metabolism slows down during the day. So it makes sense that your biggest meal should not be dinner. Don't. And the interesting thing is, when people, and I see this all the time with patients in the US, in all over the planet, when they try fasting, it's usually breakfast is the first meal they skip. I don't have breakfast, but I have a massive dinner. I don't lose weight. But that's exactly the opposite of what you should be doing. Have a massive breakfast and then skip dinner. Try that. And in most cases, that solves the issue. People don't want to do it. If they do it, they start losing weight. Don't skip breakfast. Don't start your whole fasting thing by skipping breakfast. Don't have a massive dinner. And we know, obviously, there are certain molecules and hormones at play. If you don't feed the body early in the morning, you'll have certain things happening. You'll have an increase in appetite and so on later during the day. So that's a common mistake that people skip breakfast, and then they might be able to skip lunch because they're really busy, and then they get super hungry, and then it's just between 5 and 8, it's just feasting. And that's exactly what you should not be doing.
I know personally for me, I don't have a big appetite in the morning. So, breakfast is normally my smallest meal of the day. And it's just how I'm wired. I guess maybe I could change that and force feed myself in the morning. But dinner is always my biggest meal. It always has been. However, my dinners are always earlier in the day. I mean, I grew up eating dinner at 5 o'clock. So around here, if it's 6 or 7 o'clock and I haven't had dinner, I'm like, what the hell's going on? What time? When's dinner? Whereas I have a lot of friends who they don't eat dinner until 8 or 9 o'clock at night. I'm like, what's going on here? Like, I have a bowl of Cheerios at 8 or 9 o'clock at night, and that's it, because I had dinner at 5. So yeah, I guess it's different cultural differences and so on. But and then yeah, what's habitual?
Yeah, I think you're touching, this is really, really essential, timing of meals. So obviously it's individual. For you, dinner is 5 p.m. If you go to Greece, it's 9, 10.
I first noticed
So,
that
and
when I was traveling to Italy. Like, they'd say, we have dinner plans. And this was 10 years ago or longer now. And I'm like, okay, cool. What time? Well, we'll pick you up at the hotel at 8. Like, 8? And then if I know that if I'm getting picked up at 8, I'm not eating till 9 or 10. I'm like, oh my. And then in Italy, of course, that dinner lasts 2 or 3 hours, because it's not just to eat, it's to socialize with the people you're at that meal with. So it's very different than in the US, because in the US, we want to get in, eat, and get out. right? And the restaurants want us to do that too. Now, if you're at home, that's different. But yeah, it's you're 100% correct. Yeah, cultural differences and differences between countries.
Well, Michael, before we let you go, we still need that list of things that are most important for health. I want that list.
Okay, how many items do you want on that list?
How about give us your top five?
Top five, okay. So nutrient-wise, top two are fiber and protein. Most of the people watching this are not getting enough protein and fiber. Stop thinking about anything else. It'll take care of your calories. It'll take care of all the other shit. Just get your fiber in and your protein in. Just focus on that.
Fair.
Lift some heavy stuff.
Lift weights.
Yep, can be weights. Just I don't know if you
lift rocks,
bands.
Yeah. Yeah, if you want, yeah, whatever. If you have a farm or something, just heavy things. And it goes back to what Tim said. We know that you need that resistance, right? You need that contraction. It's not enough to just walk around, which is my fourth point, actually. But you need to lift heavy stuff at least twice a week. Number four, walk a lot. Just walk a lot.
Okay.
As much as you can. Number five, sort your sleep out. And that's not just time, which is such a huge thing now. 8 hours, 9 hours, 7 hours. It's the quality that counts, that matters.
Exactly.
People sleep 10 hours. And if you look at their sleep patterns, it's 2 hours of proper sleep. So find you, and this is also amazingly, really something that we are just beginning to understand. Sleep science. We're always assuming that 8 hours is okay. We don't know that. We have, there's no solid data that it's 8 hours.
Right.
It could be seven, it could be six, it could be nine.
The military knows, right? The military, you were in the military, full military guy, right? The military knows how many hours of REM sleep you need to be at maximum potential, right? They know, and they know how far they can push you, right? If anyone's done that research and maybe not shared it a whole lot, it's military, various military branches all over the world.
Yeah. So something totally true. And I think that's really interesting. And again, promoting sports science and sports medicine, the military is obviously on top of all of this stuff, right? It's sports medicine, nutrition, performance nutrition, it's sports nutrition, sleep, recovery, and so on. So it's the quality of sleep that matters. And don't focus on 7 hours, 8 hours. Don't go to bed. Don't force yourself to go to bed. If you're not sleepy, if you're not tired, also maybe it's because you're not getting enough physical activity. You're not moving enough. So you have to examine all of that. Don't people go to bed at a specific time and then they wake up and they're tired and brain fog and not really excited, no energy. Maybe you overslept. And we know that oversleeping is a huge risk factor for metabolic diseases. So it's not just undersleeping, not sleeping enough. It's also sleeping too much. And I think it's quality of sleep that people are not paying attention to.
Can I ask one question, Joey, before we end up? I know you wanted to get him to talk about ESPM they heard before, really, but we all love supplements and obviously. So what's your one supplement recommendation that affects more organ systems than any other probably? And like, you know what I'm saying, right? I can think of one or two that I would personally respond
with. When top three. Hey, let's hear top three from Dr. Right.
Oh, top three. Well, number one is creatine, obviously.
Of course, what I thought. Yeah. And I'm guessing the other ones on the list here.
Whey protein makes the top three. Any decent protein. And then number three... Yeah, could be a couple things. What's interesting? What's new? Something.
To me, it depends on if it's performance or if it's general health.
Yeah,
I'm thinking general health. I'm thinking general health because Joey, listen, I'll let the cat out of the bag. I'll be the, you know, I'll ruin it for you. You eat fish all the time. You love fish. You love sushi, whatever else. Yep. But I don't. I don't like fishy fish. I like very neutral fish. So for me, eating tuna is a big deal. Eating salmon, eating tuna is easy, but eating salmon is a lot more difficult for me because the oily and sardines, forget it, and all that stuff. So for me, my list would be, I would say fish oil, although I know that's, you know, it's a subject that's very interesting, but I was thinking it's good for the brain, it's good for the heart, it's good for skeletal muscle, mm-hmm. so on and so mm-hmm. on. So that would be, that's my thing, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Totally agree. Interestingly, since you know that the supplement industry is also literally fishy, right? So people buy these omega-3 supplements and then there's nothing in there. There's no omega-3 in there. So it's really important. It just
stick with the good brands.
Stick with the good brands.
The ones that are always being tested.
Listen to the ISSN guidelines. Just make sure you get good supplements.
Right.
Don't buy the BS.
That is correct, sir.
Feed on or Twitter or whatever you get your info from. Just make sure it's good stuff. If you take supplements, make sure it's good stuff. And the number one place to go to is the ISSN. And I'm not saying that because it's you. It's has been and is the place to go to.
Well, much appreciated, Michael. And I do want to mention June 18 to 20, we're in Bonita Springs, Florida. You will be there. You'll be giving a talk, right? So looking forward to that. Now tell the audience, the European Society for Preventive Medicine, I know you have more than one workshop or conference. Which one am I supposed to be at? I don't yet know.
Yeah, so the European Society of Preventive Medicine is basically at the very core, it's about sports medicine, right? It's about using the principles of sports medicine. And as a physician, that means being proactive. So Lee Hood, who's one of my mentors, once wrote a paper defining P4 medicine, which is preventive, predictive, personalized, and participatory. This is what sports medicine is, right? It's prevention. So if you have an athlete, you want to prevent diseases, injuries, right? That's obviously something you think about all the time. You want to predict something. It could be performance, could be recovery, could be anything. You're thinking about that. It's personalized. A weightlifter is very different from a marathon runner or a swimmer. And it's participatory because that person, that patient has to do something. Like if I give you that medication and let you go, that's not going to cut it. That's not going to do it. So that's basically what modern medicine should be like. And we don't really have there's so many terms out there, lifestyle medicine, functional medicine, integrative medicine, and all this BS. I think preventive medicine is pretty much as close as we can get to what we want to do. It's a bit more than sports medicine because sports medicine is literally what we do, but some people feel like sports medicine is not for me because I don't do anything physically.
I think the sport part is what they get hung up on. They're like, well, I don't do any sports.
Yeah, I that's it. I literally, we get inquiries and people say, yeah, you're a sports medicine specialist, but yeah, would love to see you. I'm not a sports guy. Sorry.
Right.
Okay. It's about the principles, and everything that modern medicine embraces now, as I just said, is based on these principles. So all this longevity stuff, all the anti-aging stuff is exactly what we've been doing for 20 plus years. And if medicine wants to change and actually turn into a healthcare system, we have to become a sports medicine oriented healthcare system. And the European Society of Preventive Medicine tries to do that. So we have education, academic partnerships, and then trying to bring in industry partners to facilitate these things. Prevention, as we just we've just discussed, all the obesity, diabetes, nutrition, exercise, it's not going to be easy to solve. It's going downhill pretty fast. So we need to do something right now. We need to train a new generation of physicians, and these physicians need good partners. That means scientists, nurses, pharmacists, trainers, nutritionists, and we need to speak the same language. We need to, this is why the ISSN and ESPM, you know, it's basically the same thing, right? We're trying to prevent diseases. And that, again, you can talk about anti-aging, which is a huge thing, the singularity and all this stuff coming out of Silicon Valley. But just, if you just prevent the most common diseases, you're pretty good. You don't need to fly to Mars to do that. Can we just prevent strokes and heart attacks and prostate cancer?
Yeah, you know,
pretty good. And
yeah, all of those. Yeah, you're right. There's so much in common between, you know, the mission of ISSN and the mission of ESPM that it's a natural fit. And hopefully, you know, I'm looking forward to coming over there. Hopefully, maybe Tim can make it to the UK. And
I would love to go. So we're trying to organize the exercise focused conference for next year, June, July. So maybe just after ISSN at Oxford University, which is a very nice place. And Tim, you obviously, and the whole bunch of guys that we all, you know.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, Tim, hey, I need. I'm sorry, we're out of time. I want to thank.
And I think,
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Sorry, I think it's really important that we get this message out there and use our different channels.
Yeah.
Because sometimes people think, you know, the sports science dudes, that's fringe. You know, that medicine is fringe, and that we have lots of noise in between. So one of the things we really do is we lobby a lot. We try to talk to politicians and explain what the actual problems are. It's chronic diseases, right. You know, and this is a whole set for another podcast, but we have a national healthcare system, right? It's falling apart. So people sometimes say, oh, the US is, you know, worse off because they don't have something publicly funded. The thing is, here, everybody's paying for everybody's obesity.
Yep.
So yeah. That's a whole different thing, but it's imploding. So politicians are now beginning to understand the elephant in the room is lifestyle related diseases. So if you prevented those, and if you had just a bit of that money to use for really interesting research, myokines and rare diseases, you know, if you want to fly to Mars, fly to Mars, but we're spending billions on these diseases.
Yeah, I always say
we all have to get out there.
I always say complex cells, but simple solutions work. So, you know, a lot of times these solutions are simple. So, you know, that's a whole nother podcast, Dr. Sagner. We'll have to talk about that. But I want to thank Tim for filling in for Tony Ricci as my co-host. And Dr. Sagner, hey, thank you so much. I know it's late in the UK. Glad you stayed up with us. So much appreciated. And I look forward to having you come to the US and then myself, of course, going to the United Kingdom. So again, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Doc.
Thanks for having me. Thanks, Dick.